It's 8:15. It's time to begin. So, hi everybody. You're my guinea pigs tonight for something I've never tried before. I'm Ann Hafton. This is my concluding session for this series at Holden on Israel and Palestine issues. And this is called A Palestinian Christian Cry for Reconciliation. And I'm using as a resource, because I really encourage people to get this book by Naim Atik, called A Palestinian Christian Cry for Reconciliation. I think I'll write his name up here. And it's in the bookstore. And this copy, when I leave, will go to the library. Naim Atik is an Anglican priest in Jerusalem and the founder of the Sabeel Ecumenical Institute in Jerusalem. It's a liberation theology center, and it has several prongs to its work, but one major one is working with the Bible and working with liberation theology. And I'm now 56 years old, so you know, some years ago, when liberation theology was the happening, cutting-edge stuff in American, North American, and South American Christian studies, I was right there, you know, in my early 30s, and eager to hear that. And actually, when I came to Holden in 1979, John and Mary Schramm were here, and the hot book in town was Thomas Merton, and the secondary hot books were about liberation theology. So this theology of the cross, viewing life from the reality of the underside, from the context of poverty, was really important to my own foundations. And Naim Atik is best known for transferring this liberation theology to the people and Christian community of Palestine. This is his second book. The first one is Justice and Only Justice. And this one is his new book called A Palestinian Christian Cry for Reconciliation. So what I hope to do tonight is to try to apply some of the principles of liberation theology using a Bible story, the way the base Christian communities in Mexico and Brazil that I saw in the early 80s use the Bible to relate to their reality. We are now here at Holden Village in North America, so we don't have the reality that Father Atik is describing, but I will give some examples from his book, and then we're also going to watch a little bit of this video and help to sort of set the stage. This video is called... Dave, can you grab the package over there? It's prepared by a Quaker ecumenist named Landrum Bowling. Isn't that a wonderful name? Landrum Bowling. It sounds like a character in a horror movie.
Hello, I'm Landrum Bowling.
But he's actually a very, very sweet and very bright ecumenist, a Quaker, and for several years he directed the Ecumenical Institute at Tantur, between Bethlehem and Jerusalem. And now he writes for the Foundation for Middle East Peace, and occasionally he'll come out with a little video. They're always a little, you'll see there, it's kind of, the introduction is kind of sweetly primitive, you know, and in today's technology, here you've got this old guy, Landrum Bowling, standing in front of a couple of maps from the National Geographic and explaining, but it does get the story across. So we'll open with about 6 minutes of this video.
In the vast area of the Middle East, the Holy Land is only one small sliver. The population of Palestinians and Israelis number fewer than 10 million out of a Middle Eastern population of more than 200 million. And yet, the unresolved quarrel between the Palestinians and the Israelis, the seemingly endless bloody struggle over control of the land, this has created a situation that disturbs not only the peace of the region, but threatens the peace of the whole world. The Holy Land, so it has been called by millions of devout believers over many centuries, a land sacred to Jews, Christians, and Muslims, often also the scene of unspeakable violence. After the collapse of the Camp David talks in the summer of 2000 and the outbreak of the Second Intifada, the two sides resorted to the most horrible violence against one another. Each with stubborn self-righteousness blamed the other of indiscriminately killing hundreds of innocent civilians, many women and children. On that harsh judgment of each other, both were correct. For 4 years after 2000, Israel was traumatized by suicide bombings, buses, restaurants, crowded shopping streets. Around 1,000 Israelis killed, including many children. Israeli retaliation has always been swift and overpowering. In the same period, almost 4,000 Palestinians and their children lost their lives through Israeli military action. I've watched the tragedy of the conflict from the inside, the pain and suffering and the endless negotiations which never seem to lead to a permanent end to the killing. For 4 years as rector of the Tom Turek Medical Institute between Jerusalem and Bethlehem, I helped bring together Christian, Jewish, and Muslim scholars and religious leaders for study and dialogue, and sometimes high-level unpublicized exchanges on crucial issues. The basic quarrel, of course, is over the land. Under the Armistice Agreement of 1949, Israel held roughly three-quarters of historic Palestine. The Arabs held an area west of the River Jordan, plus the Gaza Strip. The boundary became known as the Green Line. Even Jerusalem was split in two. 18 years later, after the War of 1967, Israel established military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. Although they left the Gaza Strip in 2005, the whole of the West Bank remains under Israeli military occupation. This fact incites increasing, continuing anger and resentment among the Palestinians.
The whole system is based on a combining force subjugating Palestinian people. If you look at the military laws, if you look at the behavior of the soldiers, if you look at the bureaucratic approach of the system here.
On the other hand, Israelis insist that there is now no alternative to a military occupation.
Although we try to deny it, the reason that these people have to be there is because if they weren't there, our families and our children and ourselves would be vulnerable targets. And would, as we've seen only too many times, be blown to pieces.
A major issue is the separation barrier built by the Israelis. It's going to be 400 miles long. The purpose is to separate the Palestinians on the West Bank from the Israelis.
It's where we can most effectively stop the terrorists getting to the Jews and the Israelis that are targets for them, wherever they are, on either side of the Green Line.
It is constructed in the middle of the neighborhood. You can see on the right side Palestinian neighborhoods, and on the left side it's Palestinian neighborhoods. So the wall is constructed between Palestinians. 32,000 Palestinians will be on the other side of the wall, and here on this side, about 230,000 Palestinians will be cut off from their relatives, from their families, from the market on the other side.
I went to visit Colonel Benzi Gruber, an Israeli Army reservist, commander of a brigade of 4,000 men. What is his opinion of the wall?
The Persian wall is a very bad solution, really. If you see the way that it goes, you know, in every kilometer it goes something around 10 kilometers like this. It's, you know, not logical. You can't even think about an real army that, you know, can defend a stuff like this. And I don't think that this is the end, the solution.
It has become the symbol of everything the Palestinians hate most about the Israeli occupation. For many villagers and farmers, the wall threatens their livelihood, and they try to stop it however they can. Most of the West Bank is rural, and life for village people is precarious. Alongside the wall, the checkpoints represent the worst evils of the occupation. The experience of passing through these checkpoints is, for most Palestinians, an inescapable daily humiliation. Dr. Jad Izak, a leading Palestinian environmentalist, heads...
Well, we'll get back to that later. So grab a Bible if you don't have one. And Martha, you do have one. You just don't know where. And you guys know where they are outside if you don't have one. And we'll spend a little time looking at one of the parables and how that might relate to this situation. I have this text here, so I don't need a Bible, thanks. Everybody got one? And turn to to Luke 18, verses 1 through 8. Can I have a volunteer reader?
Then Jesus told them a parable about their need to pray always and not to lose heart. He said, in a certain city there was a judge who neither feared God nor had respect for people. In that city there was a widow who kept coming to him and saying, grant me justice against my opponent. For a while he refused, but later he said to himself, though I have no fear of God and no respect for anyone, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will grant her justice, so that she may not wear me out by continually coming. And the Lord said, listen to what the unjust judge says. And will not God grant justice to his chosen ones who cry to him day and night? Will he delay long in helping them? I tell you, he will quickly grant justice to them. And yet, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth?
This is not a parable that I have heard read that frequently in church. I'm sure I've heard it before, but I don't know how often it comes up in the lectionary. I was intrigued to read it again here in Antique's book. He points out, and I have to remind myself, in the context of this week at Holden, that Jesus was a really great storyteller. Mm-hmm. And he packs a lot into that small parable. And the writer of the book of Luke gives us this little preface that says this is a reminder to pray always or to persist in prayer. But he could just as easily have added, put a line at the top that said, "This Jesus told this story to remind us to always stand for justice." So, you know, if you look through it, you see some parts that kind of jump out. Like, there's the beginning here, there was a judge who neither feared God nor respected humans. Is that how it goes? Mm-hmm. Yeah, he neither feared God nor respected men or humans. You know, in Jesus' time, the reality of the implications of that statement are so profound, since he, you know, lived in a community where without justice, and with an unfair judge, the outcome would be tragic, could be tragic and really miserable. Because the judge in this story and in many stories represents, you know, all authority, all-encompassing authority and power. An authority that doesn't fear God or respect people is a really frightful and ominous character. Probably one of the most ominous characters in Jesus' parables. It's like the ultimate depravity or lack of moral character in the society. I mean, we have corrupt judges, but a judge in a setting like this that fears neither God nor respects humans is too much power located in a kind of depraved place. What's your sense of that? Do you have an opinion? To me, it really struck me. Because he represents the Roman Empire. And it's always important to remember about Jesus that, you know, Jesus was a low-income Jew in a Roman Empire-occupied country. He was not in the elite. He was from the lower classes in a country that didn't have its own autonomy anymore. It was run by the Romans. And the judge represents the Roman Empire totally. There aren't any other judges in Palestine at that time. So the context is that of a really hopeless situation for people who are helpless in that community. And a judge or a justice that is, this one represents is a hardened, kind of corrupt kind of authority. So the modern equivalent to Jesus's parable of the judge might be a government. It would be possible to interpret. If you were doing this theology from in a Bible study group in Bethlehem, for example, you might see that parable as that judge representing a government, that it has all authority and no respect for God or humans. In that case, it might be a government that feared neither God nor respected international law. So that's a little bit how you do liberation theology. You look at the text and say, well, how is this like what we have? How is this like our life? So again, the judge represents the Roman Empire, and the Roman Empire in Jesus' context is a completely oppressive and violent system.
But there's hope.
Yeah, down the way. It's so important to view Jesus and his followers as you know, located in this Roman imperial geopolitics. It's not, you know, the Bible stories and the Gospels and Jesus, you know, they're not just wandering around, you know, like hippies in Galilee, you know, enjoying their little picnics with the fish and the bread. They're in a setting where there is an oppressive government that's that rules every factor of their life. And that's the context in which Jesus is talking. So so if we switch, try to kind of transfer this to a Palestinian context, what do you see? Anything?
I'm just wondering how the judge got that way.
How he got that way.
And how your current, how this current situation got that way, how they got that incredibly total, powerful, fear no one kind of position.
Yeah, that's an interesting question.
But ultimately, you break them by appealing to their human weaknesses, which is like a fly. Eventually, the fly will get so annoying that he'll do anything to get rid of it.
That's a little bit like the widow, isn't it?
Yeah, that's funny.
Or a 5-year-old kid.
It says, I mean, I guess the first time I heard it, I thought that God was being compared to the judge. You know, like keep praying to God, keep trying, keep going, keep going.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
Long. But I guess, when I've read it again, I see that he will act out his will through, you know, the decisions that the judge makes. But
or maybe he will topple the judge.
Yeah, but I guess it's a twofold thing. It's the continue to pester and don't lose heart. Because it says, do not, it's in the first sentence, to pray always and not lose heart. I guess it's a twofold, to both continue to have hope in God and to continue.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think, just going back a minute, I think, you know, there's that old saying, absolute power corrupts absolutely. So, because, I mean, we know from what we know about the Roman Empire that anyone in authority in the Roman Empire had complete authority. But too much power, too much power is too much power. Too much power over vulnerable people.
And their oversires back in Rome. I mean, there was really
everybody had somebody over them that was just a little more powerful, yeah.
But they were far away, so they really were pretty much like, get away from the law.
Yeah.
And the word judge isn't exactly what the word judge means to us today. Like the book of Judges is about like military leaders who make judgments and rules. It's not like someone who's put into that position because they're necessarily
like a military occupation.
Yeah.
Right. Well, the book of Judges, that's another context of judges.
But
that's a
Hebrew
Bible.
But the people here, it's not like
judges.
Our system of judging here where they're put into position because they're necessarily impartial.
No, they're put into position because someone's got to maintain order.
Yeah.
So, a Palestinian, according to Pastor Atik, you know, a Palestinian reading of this might be that this verse describes their reality of injustice and oppression, and that the government of Israel seems to demonstrate no fear of God and no respect for humans. So they might see it. They might see it that way. Just throw that out they might see it that way. It would be possible.
I would think, especially like in Jerusalem or some place like that. For the Palestinians there, they would see, I think, a lot of the judges as...
Yeah, but remember, the judge is a metaphor for the government.
Yeah.
So they see, like, everywhere, like here at the checkpoints, they would see the power, the military power of the ruling government.
But I was thinking more of a judge. So if a Palestinian had a case in the city of Jerusalem, where they count for nothing, they'd be more apt to get justice probably in their own, in West Bank or wherever.
Yeah.
I would think it would be hopeless for them.
Yeah,
but
I'm trying to think of a situation where they would actually get a hearing. I'm not sure.
if they could even get a hearing.
Yeah.
Well,
sometimes the Supreme Court, they call it the High Court, has ruled, for example, on the direction of the wall. In several very particular cases, the High Court has actually ruled against the route of the wall, where it looked like it was going to cut off people from, but it's so small out of the 400 miles.
Because isn't there different districts? Because the different districts have.
Well, it actually went to their Supreme Court.
Oh,
what they would call the High Court.
Or go to the High Court.
Yeah. So let's talk about the widow. Who is the widow in this picture? I mean, it's clear that this. Well, in this story, this widow is. Without, doesn't seem to be have another protector. She doesn't seem to have another advocate. She's on her own.
Widows usually, what it means, unless they have the husband's family.
Yeah.
But she was obviously oppressed because it says, against my, grant me justice against my opponent or my, you know, oppressor.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what verse that is. Or she, well, she starts, she appears in the.
Verse 3.
Okay, thank you. Verse 3.
Granting justice against my opponent.
Yeah, she has a case.
She just represents
just
someone
represents.
Who has no one else protecting
yeah.
her.
Somebody alone.
This is,
I'm sure that the Palestinians feel alone, even though most of the time, because, I mean, you have your groups that are going and be supportive, so that's important, but overall, because of the situation, I'm sure they feel very alone at times. Because nothing's changing and they don't see that maybe some of us are writing Congress people or whatever, but they don't see any results of anything.
Hand me a Bible, would you, Mark? Thanks. I want to hop over there.
No, it's okay.
I think you're right. And, you know, there. It's pretty often that Jesus focuses in his, well, he has all kinds of different characters in his parables, but in this one, he seems really to focus on the most vulnerable person in society. There's hardly anybody in the time of the gospel. The gospels written are what Franz likes to call Bible days. And there wasn't anyone really more vulnerable than a widow. If a woman's husband died, she was completely dependent on the mercy of others. As you say, Martha, she might have, his family might be willing to take care of her, but that's optional. And there probably were laws about it, but they had
there
protection.
There might not have been a family.
There might not have been a family, exactly. And I think, to me, this just is Jesus' focus on the most vulnerable and oppressed segment of society, and he's created a person to represent that with the widow. You know, the husband was the breadwinner and also the protector of women in Bible days. And so without him, she could be easily exploited or taken advantage of or made homeless. Or have to, resort to some terrible measures just to survive. And this is so important in the Bible that, like the Hebrew Bible, the laws that there were specific laws that protected four groups: widows, orphans, the poor, and strangers. And those laws have continued, really. Quite intact. Those are the groups that are considered to have no one else to protect them, so God will protect them. And you often hear in the prophets, books of the prophets, these prophets, you know, railing at the kings because they're not taking care of their poor, their widows, their orphans. And the stranger, the visitor, that's also a really important tenet in Arab culture, is care for and hospitality to the stranger. So between these two, you know, the widow and the judge, the contrast is huge.
And in looking at in groups, when even in liberation theology, an oppressed group see themselves as the widow.
Exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Before the Israelis even got there, weren't the Palestinians fairly not powerful? Weren't they fairly the weakest group of Arabs? Because they weren't on oil land, they really had nothing there.
Okay, I think so.
That's something I read that somewhere. They weren't really.
They weren't the most powerful Arab group, but they had some self concept. They had a self identity. They saw themselves as a people, and they certainly they lived under the Ottoman rule. No, it was hard. Their young men had to go and serve in the Turkish army. But and then under the British, people definitely, at the end of World War I, the Western powers definitely wanted those countries with the oil under them to be under their control, to have a good treaty with them. Nobody much cared about working out the Palestinian mandate. So they weren't as, I don't think they were as beaten down as they are now. Yeah, Clary.
Is there that much violence as this shows? I was just amazed it hurt to see the violence in this, what we saw. Women, those young women.
My impression is not right now in 2009, no. What they were showing us there was between 2000 and 2002. Now, no. You don't see that degree of violence unless you think about last Christmas when Israel invaded Gaza. And that would have looked just like those tanks.
Worse.
Much worse because of the.
But it hasn't been too long that.
Because of the airstrikes.
That there was a report, though, that there was a woman that died in childbirth. Because she couldn't get through the checkpoint and get to the hospital.
Oh, yes.
But I mean,
people
violent.
Die at the checkpoints all the time. So that's a different violence.
Yeah.
It's a more insidious, daily violence. I mean, the numbers of women who have died, who have had to deliver their babies at the checkpoints, and out of those, the number of women and babies who have died, I don't even have those numbers with me anymore. But it's many. It's tragically many, because they're trying to get to a doctor, to the hospital.
Mm-hmm. How can anyone think that Armageddon or the end times are coming, or that when this is just going on like this now? You know,
I don't know what people think about that.
You know what I'm trying to say, that those who take
that they see this as good news because they think this means Jesus is coming. Mm-hmm. Like I talked about the other day. Yeah, I. Clary, I can't get into those people's mindset. I do not get it. They have a certain way of looking at the Bible, and I'm not able to access that, I'm afraid. But as I was starting to say, I guess we see the contrast pretty huge between the judge and the widow, an immense gap in amount of power. You know, he... all-powerful, her, completely no power. And there's a text here that goes, where he says, she keeps coming and saying, grant me, but for a while he refused. So he doesn't even have to really openly oppress her. He can just ignore her. Yeah, he can just not hear the case. He can just not even hear her complaint because he has all the power and she has none. She can ask, and she can ask over and over, and at first he doesn't seem to even respond. Does it look to you?
But later he decided to listen. Later.
Right, but at first.
No, yeah.
But Anne, I mean, there really isn't any justice done for the judge in the end. I mean, the only reason why he takes in the widow is just to shut her up, basically, so he can have a little bit of peace and quiet. And, you know, it's
yeah.
complete disregard for God and for everything else. It's him playing the master, kind of using him in the male context there. And I don't know why, but...
All right. That's a very important point you just made. Hang on to it. We're going to get to that judge and see if he does, see what happens to him. So I'm going to read a little section where Pastor Ateeb quotes Thomas Merton, because he talks about this kind of, this. It's so insulting that this judge won't even hear the case. He won't even listen, allow her to put her case. He just doesn't respond. It's like he doesn't have to respond.
What women in those days were in most cases considered property? They weren't even considered human.
Right.
So, you know.
So he's all powerful, she's less than human.
Right.
So here's what Merton says. This is about insidious injustice. We also have to recognize that when oppressive power is thoroughly well established, it does not always need to resort openly to the what he calls the method of beasts, because its laws are already powerful, perhaps also bestial enough. In other words, when a system can, without resort to overt force, compel people to live in conditions of abjection, helplessness, and wretchedness that keeps them on the level of beasts rather than of men and women, it is plainly violent. To make men and women live on a subhuman level against their will, to constrain them in such a way that they have no hope of escaping their condition, is an unjust exercise of force. Here he has a really important analysis about systems that are in place, not moving in to take over, but already there and intransigent. So, it's possible, this is what Ateeb says now, as you're reading this, it's possible to compare Palestinians and their vulnerability and their ultimate powerlessness to the widow, and Israel with its power and its powerful allies to, in this case, the character of the judge who can oppress, exploit, dominate at will. Yeah.
Comment about that. I kind of feel like, given that analysis, it's better to compare the judge to us, and like to the allies, really, the Western world that backs Israel. Because, I mean, the widow is bringing a case that, against an opponent to a judge. So, if you continue that analysis, Palestine is bringing case to us saying,
yes,
look what Israel's doing to me.
Bravo. That's a really good point.
Yeah.
I hadn't really thought about that when I wrote down the powerful allies, but I think you've taken it to where it sticks.
Because I feel like that contrast is even greater between Palestine and us, given all the separation, geographic and political. I mean, at least Israel is, to some extent, is in the proximity and lives with a more daily reality of that conflict.
Well,
we can just ignore and just, it's just...
Yeah, we don't have to hear her case at all.
That's
well said. So, I'm actually going to make a note of that.
Also, what's valuable in that sort of implication of who's who comes the point that it's not explained how, but the judge, I will grant her justice. So that doesn't necessarily mean that like Israel is ignored or like justice is created, and so. It's not like one. Like she wins the case, but justice is created instead. It's not. not.
Yeah, it's hard to see exactly what that means.
But it isn't like I will hear the case and then decide it's our grander justice that the judge knows what should be done.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, it's like it's a no-brainer what has to be done. So uh-huh. It's just a matter of will he do anything about it at all. Well, one feature of liberation theology is that the people looking at the text, the Bible texts, I've noticed this in Mexico, was that they always kind of knew who their, I mean, it was pretty obvious who their oppressors were, various systems. They always kind of came back to the same, but they really focused, and I was meeting with little peasant groups, very humble people. They found themselves in the story. That was the beauty. They saw themselves, who was me in this story, you know? And so maybe that's why Pastor Atik focuses a little bit now on the woman. In this next section, he analyzes the action of the woman. And he really stresses that. So there's injustice. Injustice occurs. We don't really know what it is. But she protests. She continually protests. She says, grant me justice. And so he says that this might be read in a Palestinian Bible group as, you know, we must be consistent. We must be insistent. We must be like this woman and persist in our asking. It's not a passive role, it's a really active, we have to keep at it. And then the point that he makes is that only the resolution of her request, grant me justice, only that that justice can bring peace to both the widow and the judge. Because he will, in the end, get peace from the result, as a result. There's actually, there's different translations, he says. In Arabic, the translations are sometimes more like a word. It says, though I have no fear of God, no respect for anyone, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will grant her justice. But he points out that there are translations in Arabic where it reads, or he doesn't say Arabic, he just says other translations. So she may not come and slap me in the face.
Yeah, it's in the foot. There's a footnote in
the or book. So she may not come and give me a black eye. Now, you know, what's the likelihood that a widow is going to get close enough to a Roman judge to give him a black eye? Naeem Atik asks, is it not the oppressors who usually initiate violence? What?
Yeah.
Why is he afraid of her? Even when there are nonviolent demonstrations, it's often the oppressors who send in the army to break up a demonstration with tear gas. So anyway, he points to this widow, and he compares her to like Rosa Parks and Archbishop Romero, people who are actively fighting or working for justice and not giving up. So then he goes on to say, and a community group might say, that doing justice is not the work of the widow alone or the oppressed people alone, but the work of all who witness injustice. And that's extrapolating something that's really not in this story, but it's how you might read it if you are a group that has trouble getting heard, like this widow has trouble getting heard. But those who are witnesses also have the responsibility for doing the work of justice. That kind of falls to us at that point, maybe.
I think a characteristic that
we're
sort of not acknowledging in the widow is also not simply persistence, but bravery.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. An incredible courage to be a woman, to be be a woman with no male backing.
No protector.
Right. To then approach a man, presumably the judge, and to state their case. You know,
mm-hmm.
I think,
yes.
You know, oftentimes we, my experience works a lot with folks who are involved in survival sex and sex trafficking and things like that. And an important part of that process of healing for them is transitioning from the mindset of victim to the mindset of survivor, and kind of reminding them that they are
mm-hmm.
brave
mm-hmm.
and that they have survived. Not
mm-hmm.
to just say, like, well, you are.
Yeah. I appreciate that, because on page one, one thing I was going to say at the outset is this T-shirt I saw, and I wrote it down. It was a woman named Charisse, and she was from Indianapolis. I don't know where I saw her, but I wrote it in my journal one time. She had this T-shirt: "Peace also takes courage." I wish I had that T-shirt. But that's what you're pointing to. The resolution of this, which will bring peace to both the judge and the widow, takes courage on her part, especially.
But it also, she does just keep coming and, like, stating her case. She doesn't come back and start attacking the judge.
No.
She doesn't come back and start questioning the system. She doesn't come back and bring, I don't know, it just seems that she's persistent in stating her own.
She's continually saying, "Grant me justice."
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm.
What are you getting at?
I don't know, it seems a little bit less, I don't know, it's not exactly a revolution, it doesn't seem to be advocating any kind of revolution. It advocates, like, a small, I don't know.
Yeah, I hear you.
It's
nonviolent.
Well, I think it's...
I was thinking it's nonviolent, but she's not seeking resolution. It seems like she's only seeking resolution for herself, and
yeah.
not for, like, the sake of her opponent or the judge or anyone else, which my understanding is, like, that's what nonviolence seeks, is resolution for all.
What I see is she's not taking any other kind of approach. She's only going at one direction. Just give me justice. Just give me justice.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's assumed that she's tried a lot of other things, because this is rather...
She's at a fairly high level here.
Yeah. Like, I would assume that she's gone to her opponent already and tried to make resolution there. We've gone to lower judges. I don't know what the system was like, but this is, I mean, it's pretty high up there, and she's pretty low in that social system.
Well, Pastor Atik points out that this demand for justice is never stilled. It just goes on until the judge concedes to her, and that's a point that you can carry over into political action. Even though the parable doesn't directly call for strategic action, it does have a sense that this demand for justice has never stilled. And in spite of the fact that oppressors can drag their feet, like, he's just like, "Oh, please, don't make me deal with her." And oppressive systems, you can see them hoping that people will just lose interest and be quiet and stop asking. At least that's my opinion about systems and oppressive systems. And they seem to hope that people will just get used to their situation and whittle down their demands or settle for an unjust compromise.
Or blaming the victim.
So advocates, I mean, I see myself as an activist, so in here I see that the role of the advocate is to not give up. If the goal is liberation for both the judge and the widow, then you know, to persistently advocate for justice for both the oppressed and the oppressor. That's the imperative I take out of it. I mean, me personally.
And she is taking a big risk because there's other ways you could get rid of her besides giving her justice.
Gotcha.
A guy that powerful could just make her disappear.
Just make her go away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So she's taking a huge risk.
Let's go to Jesus' closing lines, or the closing lines of, I think it's verse 6 through the beginning of verse 8. And the Lord said, listen to what the unjust judge says. And will not God grant justice to his chosen ones who cry to him day and night? Will he delay long in helping them? I tell you, he will quickly grant justice to them. And yet, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth? What's going on here? Is Jesus being, like, sarcastic, or?
Is that a reference to, like, end times?
Well, it's a kind of a shorthand. It's not necessarily end times, but there's always a reference to when the Son of Man comes. Jesus always talks that way. I'm not sure he means the Armageddon, but he means like right now. Anytime. I think. But these almost sound like sarcastic questions. It's getting late, isn't it?
I don't know.
The line that God says, he will quickly grant justice to them.
Yeah, so
because in God's time, quickly can be, you know, 1,000 years. But you just wonder, you know, when you read that, you know, you're hoping quickly is what we did quickly, you know, within a day or a couple hours or something. And that's not happening. So in some ways, it can be discouraging that we've been doing all this, God. We've been coming to the judge. We've been doing this, and we've been advocating our case, and nothing's happening. What does quickly mean?
To me, the troubling line is, and yet when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth? And because we've been talking about the story in the context of, like, justice and injustice,
mm-hmm.
but the opening is about needing to pray always and not lose heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the end of all your struggle and your persistence, and nothing has changed, can you still have hope? Can you still have faith? Is your heart still open to God? It seems like it can have this active, this very active or like action-oriented.
The body
in,
of it.
Inside, yeah, but then wrapping it all up.
Yeah, it's kind of mysterious.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I think we're going to get to that last part about faith in a minute. Just want to go through a couple of quick points, and then I think we'll get there. Like Atik says that in Arabic, this text reads, "Listen carefully to what the unjust judge has said." I don't know why it's that way in Arabic. I don't have an Arabic, and I don't read Arabic. But he says it reads, "Listen carefully to what the unjust judge says." So I think what Pastor Atik says is that ordinary people to whom Jesus is speaking with his parable, they can detect hypocrisy and corruption pretty easily. So it sounds like he's almost saying, don't take it at face value. Listen for, have your ears open, have your heart open. Pay attention, listen carefully to what the judge says. I don't know. I think that's true, at least. And I used to work in a community action agency, and it seemed like the poor people that I worked with, they had an uncanny sixth sense for hypocrisy or BS. And they could tell right away if something was not genuine. And somehow, this seems to be, this is Atik's analysis of what Jesus is saying here. The confidence, the promise out of this is that, you know, God is a just God, and this, the God in whom we believe is a just God, and it has to end, so the story has to end with justice. Jesus and the prophets say so. So there's also a little part I wanted to read here from what Atik writes. The God in whom we believe and hope is not a divine warrior who strikes down the oppressors and imposes justice through an iron rod of judgment. Our liberator is the God of Jesus Christ, who suffered the shame on the cross. It is the God who did not create us as automatons, but human beings with free will to choose, even to choose to disobey and reject God. So in the face of injustice, we believe in a God that is just. And so Atik says there's no question but God has built the world on justice. I really struggled with that line. God has built the world on justice. I'm not sure what he means. But he says, he asks the question, are humans, God's beloved, working with God on justice? Are judges exercising justice? These are his questions. And yet they have this last verse on about faith. How does that relate to this story? Atik asks, he suggests that it asks the question, will the people be committed to justice? And it throws out a challenge. Will we care about the oppressed and advocate for justice? This last part about will he find faith on earth? Will he find the people cared about the oppressed and advocated for justice? Will we stand before the world's powers and insist that justice be done? So quickly, maybe we haven't done our job yet. I'm just positing. And then Atik writes, only true faith will produce such courage. That's his definition of this faith, that the courage to care about the oppressed and to advocate for justice and to stand before the world's powers and insist on justice. And really, now in a real base Christian community, liberation theology, the leader doesn't put out the answers. You have to come to them on your own. But you see, you did. You came to it way before we got there. So I applaud you.
He was asking about justice for the judge, I guess. And you said something about peace with the judge, but was that all that it is? I guess what I struggle with...
Will the judge be judged?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm at this point where it's just sad that she's having to seek justice from someone who's so ambivalent about it. And it's just tossed out there, almost for his own amusement.
The powerful play with the puppets.
Yeah. And this is where I'm, for myself, this is where I'm adjusting the line, he will quickly grant justice to them, is that once you have it, you really don't care how you got it. And I think that's where, for myself, that's where it would equal out. It's, you know, sad that she's got to seek this justice from this judge who could care less about her. But once she has the justice, it's earned. And, you know, she may forget about all the trials that she went through for it.
Do you think he has to have her forgiveness to have peace? Peace
no.
within himself?
I don't think so.
Or just peace from... from fear that she's going to blacken his eye.
He's getting away with the negative.
I think the judge is just going to get away with all this.
Right.
And I can't, for myself, where is the justice for the judge? The fact that he has contempt you know, for no one. And you know, this woman is practically begging. And it's child's play. And I wonder where is it going to go for him?
I just see it as even an unjust person will do justice. So you sure ought to believe God's going to. That's where I see it.
Mm.
That it exists in bad conditions even. So isn't God going to be much more so, and we should believe that. But I think of almost the whole world. This is the case for women.
Well, and maybe it points to a possible reality that you won't ever change the judge. That those systems or similar systems will continually arise.
But he's still doing justice.
Sure.
Even though he's a poor, bad man.
Well, he's giving out judgments. Whether he's giving justice or not is a different.
Well, it says he grants her justice.
He grants her justice in this case. Yeah.
So won't God do much more than that?
Well, I don't think he's the metaphor for God.
No, he isn't. But it says if even an unjust judge will do justice, God certainly is going to.
Mm-hmm. Will not God grant justice to his chosen ones who cry day and night?
What I was thinking, she was saying was that, what I was thinking of it was that there's always going to be judges out there. There's judges that are going to always be in the world. And, I think that's where I was seeing the end, where it, when God comes back, will there be faith at the end of that? Because there will be judges out there all the time.
I think that what I got from this analysis in Atik's book is that this question about will there be faith throws out the challenge to the reader, to the hearer of Jesus' parable. Will we have the courage to advocate for the powerless? And that takes, that's the reflection of faith that he's talking about.
Because we already know the judge, that he won't find any faith in the judge. We know that. So where is he going to find the faith?
Right.
Because it's not going to be with the judge. Is it going to be with the oppressed? Is it going to be with the oppressor? The opponent? No.
And the advocates.
Well,
I'm going to show the last little 3-minute segment of this video before I excuse you, because I want this to go completely off subject.
Has a research institute in Bethlehem.
Or go back to the menu. Do you want to go back to the menu?
Oh, sure.
this is now a complete digression, but here Landrum Bowling talks to a member of the group called the Bereaved Families Forum. And he talks to a Israeli father who lost his daughter in a bombing. He and I met with him, our group met with him a year ago, and he always has with him a Palestinian who has also lost a child to violence. Just happens in this case that Bowen only talks to the Israeli, but the message is the same. Go down to December 7th.
Well, 7 years ago, on the 4th of September, 1997, we lost a daughter to a Palestinian suicide bomber who blew themselves up in Beni Huda Street in Jerusalem. And this has changed our lives totally. And from this enormous pain, from this tragedy, we decided to do something with it, in order to try and prevent more bereavement, more pain. So we are engaging in an organization which is called the Bereaved Families Forum for Peace, an Israeli-Palestinian joint organization, which tries to create hope out of this endless pain.
What kinds of things specifically do you do? What activities do you carry out?
Oh, so many things. the most important thing that we do is lectures in high school. Last year we gave more than 1,000 lectures.
In Israel?
In Israel and in Palestine.
And in Palestine.
Yeah, we step into an Israeli or a Palestinian class, usually together with a Palestinian partner, and talk about hope, talk about reconciliation, talk about dialogue. The fact that we are bereaved opens the door, opens the heart, because in the Israeli society and in the Palestinian society, bereaved families are respected tremendously. And this is it, this is the basic of it, looking forward and trying to solve this matter. And the only way to solve it is by listening
to the other.
Yeah, by understanding. You don't have to accept everything, but you have to listen. You have to try and understand. And the basic problem, the essence of everything, is the total blindness of the two sides to the narrative and the pain of the other. And the greatest danger to the future of Israel, the Jewish democratic state in the future, is the continuation of the occupation. And the occupation goes on with the American support. And the minute the Americans will understand it, which the Europeans seem to be understanding it for the last years, then what is necessary will be done. And what is necessary is that the Americans will initiate a peace process which will be just.
I'm talking as the son of a Holocaust. But my father is an Auschwitz graduate. And 60 years ago, well, they took my grandparents to the ovens in Europe, the free and civilized world, stood aside and never lifted a finger. And today, while these two crazy people are massacring each other, the free and civilized world is still standing aside and almost doing nothing, not only that, but supporting one side almost unconditionally. And why? And begging from people when I end any lecture of mine is not to stand aside, is to show some feeling, some understanding, some and try to solve this horrible conflict before it will finish us all.
The most insistent challenge to all of us is not to stand aside. Since the United States is the only country that clearly has decisive influence with both sides, we have the obligation to provide imaginative diplomacy backed by our wealth and power. The President, the Secretary of State, and the Congress should hear from the American people that we support full, unflagging, determined work to make a negotiated peace happen.
So, thanks everybody for taking part in this experiment, and see you next year.